Session number 13522.
Mr. O'Brien, reel 5.
You learn to be understanding. You realise material things are not important, and the fact of the fact that you appreciate life is something more meaningful. I continued on to serve 22 years in the Royal Marines. I'm very proud of every moment I served. And I also learnt that the young chaps who I had to train, you began to realise that you didn't just have to shout and say you've got to do this. You guided them along. You taught them all the things you knew. And you've got a certain understanding of life whereby some people will say, oh, why doesn't he shout at him for doing that? Even when you're at home, you know, you think, well, what is the point? Because life is so precious that you've got to appreciate it. And you don't really appreciate it until you've had a situation like that where you come out and you're one of the lucky ones to have survived. I'm trying to remember all the things that happened. We went back to Japan on an American ship, and we went to a camp just outside of Tokyo. It was a camp called Ebisu Camp, an Australian signal camp, and it was the nearest we could be placed to the area where we had been doing our first landings in Japan at this other camp, McGill. And we were waiting on reinforcements to come out from the Royal Marines, bearing in mind that we were way out in Japan. There was no aircraft that brought you out, you know, as you do today. You either had a special aircraft laid on like a Dakota, or you came by ship. So we had to wait for some replacements, which were sent from Malaya, and a few that came out from England, the more specialist types who'd been, you know, to replace casualties. And so this was the situation when we were at Ebisu Camp in Tokyo. I'd like to speak a little bit about Japan, because in Japan at the time, it was recovering from World War II. It was occupied by mainly the American forces, occupation army, and the Japanese were feeling their feet. Now, I cannot comment on the Japanese side of people who were in World War II, because as a young boy, I cannot understand and would never try to understand the things that happened to our prisoners of war of the Japanese. So please don't misunderstand me. I'm looking at it as a young chap who is now in Japan, which is a new country to him, of people who have been conquered, and not the atrocities they committed as a Japanese army. Now, everywhere we went in Japan, the Japanese were actually over-polite. They had changed their tune from a war people to people who had been conquered, but they did not show as if to say they're downtrodden. I believe it's their makeup that they had lost the war, so they accepted it. You know, if you'd have said, I'm going to kill every one of you, they would have accepted it. But the Japanese at the same time were living on next to nothing. And being a young Marine and still not getting much pay, we were looking for somewhere to spend some dollars to buy a few souvenirs. And so what I'm saying now is some of the things which would not be recognised as right by our fellow officers. We were in this camp, and the situation, winter time, so you could have as many blankets on your bed as possible. We were really well looked after. But at the same time, when you went into Tokyo, you found that the prices of stuff you might wish to buy, I bought tea sets and things like that for my sister, you know, sent them home, and they arrived home and without a peace being broken, but you needed a bit more money than the Americans. And so, being slim, I used to wrap a blanket all around my body and put my uniform on and march out the gate of this camp, whereby the Japanese would be waiting to buy anything, be it a bar of soap or anything. It's the usual black market affair you get after a war, whether it's England, Germany or wherever. The black market people are there to buy stuff from you. And I was not the only one, but you used to get 1,000 yen, which was £1 sterling, for one blanket. So I would say, my mate's ashore, he's left his blanket, so I'd take one of his and wrap it around my body. Out I'd go in an alley, off it would come, and I'll get 1,000 yen, you see, whereby I could go out and have beer all night long, you know, and buy a couple of presents. My mate comes back, sees one of his blankets gone, so he pinches one of mine and then takes another one and he sells another one as well. So after a week, there was a shortage of blankets in this camp. And every time you went down to get some new blankets, the sergeant in the stores is saying, "What are you doing with all these blankets?" "Well, we're freezing, you know." What must have happened when we finally left there and they just went round to count the blankets? I can imagine some poor stores person must have had to write something out, like, you know, had to be written off, because this is the sort of thing that any serviceman gets up to. And being from the East End of London, I was using my wits, as you might say. These were the lighter side moments of being in 441 Independent Commando. We were very, very fortunate in the fact that we were such a special unit that we were not like the unfortunate Commonwealth Brigade, who were literally bogged down in Korea for 18 months, 2 years at a time. I honestly say that must have been terrible, because I must say it, the British serviceman was not very well equipped because of the way Britain was gearing itself up after having gone through so many years of war. They were not as well equipped clothing wise as the American forces, whereas we had the cream of it. We had American clothing, we had American weapons, we had American dollars, we were in Japan. And so we may well have been the envy of quite a few people. And this is exactly what happened because of that. There's General Robertson of the Australian Forces, who was the officer commanding the Commonwealth Brigade. I'm saying this as a Marine, not as an officer or a politician. He had his eye on using 4-1 Independent Commando. And he used his position, rightly or wrongly so, to say, they're going to come under my wing because I want to use them to do various tasks. He could well have put us in a front line in Korea or made us into raiders or whatever. But he said, they are British. You've had them long enough to the Americans. I want them now. So we then, all this was happening above our heads as a Marine. We were then shipped from the comforts of Tokyo and whatever down to Kure in South Japan, where the British Commonwealth Forces bases were, as far as being in Japan was. And they didn't have anywhere to put us. We went by train about a day and a half or 2 day trip, and we were put into the cinema in the dockyard of Kure. And by the cinema, I mean it was a vast hall with a stage where they used to put a lot of chairs out and have a film show or whatever. Put up a load of beds in there. That was our accommodation. That's where I was. Brought in some lockers and living very, very, very rough and Spartan, purely because I'm not saying it nicely, the British general wanted us to be there. But what he didn't realise was the American government, having asked for us to be formed and work with the American Navy and American Marines, had been paying American dollars from the American government for all our equipment, all our weapons, all our pay. And so Britain had not had to foot any bills whatsoever. The moment we became under General Robertson, the American says, right, they're yours. And though we continued to get paid in American dollars, because we then went back and forth, which is a bit more onto this story, we were still under the Americans because of what we were doing, Britain had to pay for it. So really, it cost a few thousand and more pounds, which had to be paid into dollars to pay us. So it would have been better if he'd have left the Yanks to say, right, carry on, because I'm sure they would have still cooperated. Now, 1951 saw a slightly different role in the fact that we'd done all these commando raids. Then we'd been at Chosin. Now, the situation in Korea was that they were pushing up north again, and they got to the 38th parallel when they started bargaining as to what was going to happen to which. And what could they do with us? Right, they said, well, we'll do a couple of big raids and see what that happens. So we rehearsed and did a combined daylight raid lasting a complete day on Songjin, which is way up past the 38th parallel. And we landed from an American amphibious carrying tank landing craft type ship called the Fort Marion. And we did a landing on a beach after it having been softened up with gunfire from American naval ships. And we did a daylight landing, and we mined and demolitioned quite a long section of railway track and a tunnel to put the communication lines of the from North Korea down through to South Korea by really disrupting it for a long period. And we spent a whole day doing this. My task on it was as a rifleman on a perimeter in case we were attacked, while the demolition teams were working doing all the demolitions. We landed in Amtraks, which are amphibious tanks which carry troops. These were used in World War II by the American forces, well, I think on D-Day, etc. And they were very, very heavily armoured, so that when you laterally hit the beach, the Amtraks would go up the beach on the tracks, having gone through the water and up on it. And the, instead of opening at the front like a landing craft and being open to any fire, they opened up at the back and you came out of the rear of the Amtrak. So therefore, you've lessened the situation of whereby if they were under fire, you could go to ground and still be pretty safe because you come out the rear end instead of the front end. And we landed in them, and we were there from dawn till it started getting dark. And we pulled out just as a massive, great mass of troops were being brought to engage us and whatever. And we got out there without any casualties. There may have been a couple of casualties, you know, on Americans, and I think it may have been one of us, but it was nothing really, not a patch on Chosin, as you might say. It was nothing. We landed, did all its demolitions, and just before we got attacked, we pulled out. Now, they then took us back to Japan, and Colonel Drysdale, obviously having been back and forth in conference, made a decision whereby we would continue doing some raids, but to try to cut out this business of going from Japan on a ship and then on back again to Japan, we would be put on some islands behind the enemy lines. Now, Wonsan Bay is in North Korea, and on the northeast coast. And in that bay, if you can imagine Plymouth Sound, with a couple of little islands dotted here and there, that is one sand bay. And there's several little islands there. It's about, at that time, was about 60 miles behind the enemy lines, because the 38th parallel was being argy-bargied back and forth, and troops were digging in on full defensive while talks were being going on. But at the same time, there were action things happening as far as warfare. We were up in one sand. We landed by night, and over a period of a week, we dug in August 1951. We dug into the hillside on the seaward side of this little island, which was about 2 miles off the mainland of Wonsan. It took us about a week to get ourselves dug into the hillside. We put tents up, camouflaged them, and we also had dug defensive positions all around the island in case we were attacked. And we manned these all the time, but at the same time we had a watch-keeping routine whereby you could relax on the seaward side and you'd be on watch on the sides that looked towards the land, like, you know. And we continued on there for about 3.5 months. And what we were doing, we were we were on the islands from August to November, and what we were actually doing was, there was another larger island a bit more towards the seaward side of the bay where a lot of the rest of the 4-1 commando were, and we were gradually each night carrying out recce patrols and checking the beach all round this big bay in preparation, unbeknown to us, for a big landing which was being planned, like D-Day, whereby the American forces would do a big landing and retake Wonsan and come back down in a pincer movement to whatever as regards the tactical side of warfare. And we were doing this quietly while paddling ashore in canoes. We had a couple of Klepper canoes as well as our rubber inflatable boats, whereby they paddle in and recce the beach. And at the same time, we had a little landing craft whereby we'd cruise up and down with the engine running very quietly in case they came under fire, and we'd give them protection fire to help them to get back out, and we get back to the island again. And so this situation continued, whereby once every few weeks we would also go on board an American destroyer and do a normal night commando raid somewhere along the coast. Only we didn't have to go back to Japan. They'd bring us back, and at night time we get back on the islands again. Now, if I might say a little bit about living on the island as far as the everyday situation, we had American rations. We had air support should we need it if we were attacked. We had support from capital ships which were in the area should we really come under, you know, dire and necessary of being rescued, etc., from a full-scale attack on us from the mainland. So we felt pretty safe, even though we were behind the lines. And in Wonsan itself, behind the town, there were some high ridges of mountains, etc., and hidden in these mountains were quite big guns which were on railway lines, which would be in caves, and then they'd trundle out, fire and trundle back. And the American ships were trying to find a way, or the American forces were trying to find a way to destroy these guns, either by air attack, but it didn't have any impression because they were hidden in the caves, or by firing them from ships, once again, are in the caves. So the only thing they decided to do was to tempt them out, and that way they might catch them, much like a cat trying to catch a mouse. And so we'd be sitting on this little island, the Modo, which was like about 500 yards long by 150 yards wide, like a little bubble, covered in very small trees and scrub. We're sat amongst the trees on a nice sunny August, September day, because it's summertime at last and we're quite warm, watching American ships come in stern first by the island, getting ever nearer and nearer to the coast of Wan San, until suddenly, watching through our binoculars, we see little black dots appear, and a few seconds later, the flash of a gun being fired, and the next thing is a whistle of a shell, and it plummeted into the water around the American ship. In the meantime, the American ship, having lured the guns out of the caves, would open up with everything they got to try and hit the gun. And it was like sitting at a cinema show, watching this happen. And we used to lay bets, you know, not literally money, but, you know, say, I'll bet it doesn't hit this one this time. Like, very, very, very callous, really, but you didn't think of them being injured or anything. And occasionally an American ship would be hit, like, you know. And this went on all during the period we were there, gradually increasing sort of thing, until one afternoon we're sat there amongst the scrub watching all this happen, and they switched the angle, and suddenly we were being shelled. Like, they'd found out we were on the island, and they, from then onwards, they started intermittently shelling us all the time. But fortunately, we dug all our positions for when we were being shelled, etc., on that side of the island, as well as having the positions for being attacked on other parts. Like, so we suffered very, very small casualties. Some were a little bit shell fragments, things like that. One young boy, you always got these little boys that you sort of adopt, like, you know, he was killed, and he was a lovely little boy. They had a couple of fishermen's huts on this island, and he obviously belonged to the family, and we dressed him up in a marine, gave him a green berry and this sort of thing, you know, and he was all right. But then as we left, we heard about a week later that he'd been killed in a shelling, like, you know, which was very sad, you know. It little things like that hit you more than 10 men being killed. You see a little youngster being killed. We used to throw grenades into the water, and they would stun the fish, and fish would float to the surface, and we'd have fresh fish as food. We'd occasionally go out on this little landing craft and rendezvous with a ship. I went on HMS Belfast, which is in the River Thames. We went out there one evening, and on we went onto the Belfast, and it's exactly as you see it today in the River Thames. We went on board there. There was Royal Marines on board there. We had lovely hot showers, because we used to have to wash in the sea with green salt water soap when we had a bath. There was a well on the island, but that was used primarily for fresh drinking purposes, and the fishermen who were on this, who owned this well, obviously didn't want us 30-odd chaps, there was about 30-odd of us, drinking all and washing, using it for washing as well. So we used to wash in the sea, in this little bay on the seaward side, and use salt water soap for having a daily bath. When we went on board the Belfast, I grabbed a sack of onions and pinched that, as well as them giving us a lot of fresh baked bread. You might laugh. We grabbed all the corned beef we could. We grabbed all the hard tack biscuits, which is the typical English rations, as much of that as we could. We grabbed as many British cigarettes as we could out of the naffy. I pinched a sack of onions, and somebody else got some potatoes and this sort of thing. And back we went on the island, and corned beef might sound, you know, fancy having that, but when you have living on American rations, which is chicken and noodles and, you know, meat and beans and this sort of thing, all in tins, you long for something to really be a bit more stock food that you can really fill yourself up with. And these were our times of relaxation where they say, well, there's a, you four can go on board Belfast tonight because it's rendezvousing with us, like, you know, or so forth. And that's how we used to be supplied, etc. Now, a typhoon hit us while we were there, which was a tail end of one that hit Japan. And as I was explaining, we had this small landing craft, which would carry about 20 men at the most, which we used for communications to get on supplies off any ship. We also used it with a machine gun on, because I was a machine gunner now, with the different tasks you get on the different jobs. And you use that to patrol quietly up and down, protecting our chaps who were ashore with the, doing the wreckage of the beaches. And this landing craft was our sole means of either escape or getting from one place to another, apart from the rubber boats and the canoes. And one night this storm hit us, and it carried on for about 4 days. It was the tail end of a typhoon. And the landing craft, being on the seaward side, started to get damaged, and the ramp started to get smashed up with it being pushed around on the beach. So we thought, we'll have to take it around to the seaward side and take a chance of it being spotted the next day by the Chinese or whatever. And we were taking it in turns to bail this out, wearing our swimming costumes and just got your gun on your shoulder sort of thing. And tidied it all up, got a big rope on it, and started to go it round with the engine running to gradually move round the island like that. And we had a long rope on it in case the engine broke down because of the way the waves were. There was five of them in the landing craft. It just so happens, you know, with the chopping and changing around, these particular five happened to be in it. And as it's a small island, you can understand little bits coming out like that with a rope going up. With the rope attached to the landing craft and the remainder of us on the shore holding on to this long rope, the waves of the wind of the storm gradually took the small craft around from the seaward side of the island to go round into the leeward away from the wind. Unfortunately, the full strength of the wind hit this boat as it actually went past the side of the island, and the rope we were all holding on to, having taken a couple of turns round a tree, that parted, just snapped, and off in the darkness drifted the small landing craft with five of our friends inside. One was a sergeant major, a chap called Happy Day. Another was a sergeant. There was a corporal, John Pesquet. There was another young friend of mine,